From the heart of Hitler Germany, your messenger Paul Revere greets you again. Countrymen, friends, foes, Jew haters and Jew servers. Before proceeding to embark on the theme which I have selected for my tonight's discourse, I must make reference to my last talk, the Paul Revere message of Wednesday, September 23rd. It was based upon an open letter to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a letter written by a very distinguished American citizen of some 80 years, who with his wife is residing in Florence, Italy, an exile. Yes, an exile from Roosevelt's corrupt empire. The writer of that letter, Mr. Joshua Crane, internationally known philanthropist, sportsman, socialite, student of the world's political panorama, graduated in 1890 from Harvard University. Dear friends, keep in mind that your betrayer in the house that once was white is also a graduate of Harvard. That revered alma mater in Cambridge by Boston has to bear its own share of the blame for Roosevelt's anti-American deeds. Mr. Joshua Crane's letter attracted much attention amongst certain Harvard graduates who live here in Germany. So great was their interest that I was bombarded by requests to repeat the letter in another broadcast. Therefore, for the benefit of those American listeners, especially Harvard listeners, who failed to tune in last Wednesday night, I wish to announce that on Monday night, day after tomorrow, my two broadcasts will contain a repetition of Mr. Crane's righteous indictment of America's, quoted, great white cheat in the White House. Amen. So much for that. Tonight we are on the eve of the third birthday of the Axis Pact. 3 years ago tomorrow, Germany, Italy, and Japan underwrote the historic agreement which stands today as the indestructible barrier against plutocratic reaction. For 3 years, the Axis partners have marched from victory on every front, from victory to victory on every front, military, diplomatic, economic. For 3 years, the democratic opponents of world progress, led by Churchill the charlatan and Roosevelt the renegade, have sought to substitute deeds, little deeds, with words. All their futility, all their shameful incompetence, these men have tried to cover behind an impenetrable smoke screen of lying words. The military defeats of the benighted nations they have camouflaged under the cunning ruse of, we quote, successful strategic withdrawals, or, more flamboyantly, glorious retreats. From the debacle of Dunkirk to the present crushing of the Soviet backbone at Stalingrad, the same technique has been employed. Was Singapore important, I quote, important, after the moment of its imminent fall? Ah, brothers, I ask you, no, no, no. Britain washed out the whole affair with a few gushing glamour words. Did the loss of North Africa's coast cause the British broadcast boys even a little tremor? emphatically no. Well, thus it goes with every ignominious British Allied rout from the whale-spouting Arctic Sea to the spot where the dawn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay. But there are two other fields where the lie makers of the Brit Yank press and radio have showed an equally vigorous and perhaps even more skillful hand. First and foremost is the time-honored prophecy of economic ruin. Germany will burst asunder economically before the end of the first winter. That was World Judah's theme song in 1939. The world has seen to what extent this prophecy held true. Have you heard the latest figures on bank deposits in the booming Reich? If not, it's your own fault, for these figures are regularly published in the Berlin shortwave broadcast. You'd better listen regularly, not miss a broadcast. You can't project the war's outcome unless you are informed on all of such significant factors as these. And don't forget that your survival, your American survival, as an exponent of the American way of life, depends on the righteous rightness or the filthy wrongness of Boss Roosevelt's dirty scheming. The second factor with which the world destroyers have reckoned to affect your befuddlement is the question of Europe's nourishment. The way to a man's heart is through the stomach. Ah, that's an old slogan that's been employed since Adam's day by Eve's sisters on their own sacred, feminine propaganda front. Wars are won by well-fed bellies. That also has been the squawk of world enemies of Christian civilization. Hunger will beat the Nazis. Ah, yes, hunger will beat the Nazis. Europe is on the verge of starvation. Oh, have you not seen these statements ad nauseam splattered over the front pages of your own daily papers? A belly full of straw, that is the best that the continental dweller can expect. A belly full of straw, well, thus it goes. The Axis battle for food has long since been won. The richly productive agrarian territories, which have been brought into the field of Axis economy in the last year and 3 months, have set at naught all the dire prognostications of Axis enemies. Poland's rich flatlands are, under an intensive cultivation unknown in the days of ruthless Jewish exploitation, keeping northeastern Europe granaries filled to an unprecedented level. The Baltic states are resuming their former position as jammers full of the milk-butter-egg icebox. The Ukraine was, in the pre-war days, conceded by benighted nation enemies as the answer to the hungry European maiden's prayer. But look at the Ukraine today. In spite of the ravages of military strife, in spite of all this, the area has, since the first days of the most immemorial year, been cultivated up to 70% of its productive potential. The Ukraine is hitting on all 16 cylinders, or perhaps 24, and you may do well to remember the words of your government misinformers that this Ukraine district, this same Ukraine district, would spell the success or failure of Europe's nourishment battle. England and war-wearied America have been appallingly disappointed at the Soviet failure to deliver their promised measure of military murder. The Soviets are, on the other hand, groaning with disgust at the incompetence of their pious Western brothers in blood. The Donets and the Donbasins are long since lost. The Kuban territory is occupied. The Caucasus will be forced to bow its head and say to the Axis brothers, "Ah, well, here you are, gentlemen. Take what you will." They will say that when the last Red Army remnant has capitulated before the German Allied drive. In the meantime, the belly of the commissar-driven Soviet soldier is growing more and more dependent upon such belly straw as he can clutch from the wayside in his precipitate withdrawals. And the home front worker, driven to ultimate capacity in Stalin's race for defensive production, he must take up another notch or two in his belt in case he has not already been driven to the extremity of eating his pants holder, his belt. According to the latest glorious retreat on the food rationing front of the Kilgard hordes, there is to be something less than 0.5 pound of meat per month for each of the batters on the Bolshevist home front. England still smacks its lips and tells of a slightly sub-Ritz bill of fare for its coolies. The English rationing sounds rather thrilling unless you put your ear to the thermostat on Mr. Churchill's Frigidaire. Then comes the awful awakening. The rationing organized by Mr. Weary Winston Churchill is not based upon a fixed amount per weight, leaving the scale to pronounce a Solomon judgment as to the justice of the matter. No, but upon a pro-shilling basis. Perhaps this plan has its merits, but it would seem to me that the benefit is somewhat obscure. I, Paul Revere, personally prefer the good, honest German method of announcing rationing in ounces and grams. Just how much chow are you going to be able to set your teeth in next Monday morning? That is the question. An American writer stated in the Saturday Evening Post, last May, that the game was definitely up as far as the Jewish boogaboo of starving Nazis was concerned. Said this gentleman, and don't fail to remember his subsidized viewpoint, "It will be a good 5 years before the German army and its great home army of supply-producing labor become pinched for food." End his quote. Ah well, even the centipede goes on his way on invisibly moving legs. But each of those legs must be motivated by a well-nourished body. The Axis centipede is assured of adequate nourishment for even 0.5 decade, according to your own Saturday Evening Post commentator. What are your Soviet and Brit accomplices in crime depending upon for their nourishment? Fee-fi-fo-fum, I smell the blood of an Englishman. Be he alive or be he dead, I'll grind his bones to make my bread. Churchill and Roosevelt are offering the bones of their own countrymen to make bread of victory.